Doing some excellent, excellent reading here. You are tuned in to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM, where we feature a variety of spoken word programming.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain. On the web at cjsf.ca, and we are pleased to air a reading by novelist Gurjinder Bazarn that was hosted by the Special Collections Department here at SFU's Bennett Library. Gurjinder Bazarn is a fiction writer from North Delta and is a graduate of SFU's Writer Studio. Gurjinder will be reading from her debut novel, Everything Was Goodbye, which was published in 2010 to excellent reviews, was awarded the BC Book Awards Ethel Wilson Fiction Prize in 2011, and won the Next Great BC Novel Contest, which was put on by Mother Tongue Publishing Limited. A question and answer period will commence directly after the reading. Please enjoy.
So I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning, give you a sense of the storyline, characters, narrative, and then I'll be happy to answer any of your questions as it relates to writing or the novel. The smell of chai, fennel, cloves, and cinnamon tucked me into my blanket like a seed in a cardamom pod. I steeped myself into the warmth of waking, listening to the sounds of Sunday morning. My mother was in the kitchen, scrubbing the sink, her steel gutta clinking against the basin, keeping time with the shabbat on the radio. When I was 15, I told her I didn't want to wear my gutta anymore. I didn't like the idea of being handcuffed to God. My mother, to my surprise, hadn't argued with me, but simply said that the gutta was a symbol of the restraint I would learn to show, whether I wore the bangle or not. "Is Mina not awake?" my mother asked, her voice cracking through intermittent radio static. "Get up, Maninder. It's 11 o'clock. My sister Tej was the only one who used my real name. She knew how much I hated it. I heard her footsteps in the hallway and pulled the blanket over my head. "Just 5 minutes. No, not 5 minutes. Mom wants you up now. I don't know why you think you should get to sleep in while I get stuck with all the chores. You're such a brat." Tej yanked the blanket off and looked at me with disgust. I was sleeping in a tank top and panties, instead of the old lady nightgowns that Musty had sewn for us from scraps salvaged from the textile mill. "Fuck off, Tejinder." I shut my eyes against the light and pulled the blanket over my shoulders. "Why can't you wear proper pajamas like everyone else, or at the very least, a bra?" "You're just jealous." Tej crossed her arms over her flat chest and stared me down, silent and saintly, until I felt the familiar beginnings of guilt harden in my stomach and take root in my toes. She reached across the bed, drew the blinds, and slid the window open, filling my room with the sounds of barking dogs, sprinkler jets, and crows. When I turned my back on Tej, she shook my shoulder, stood over me, arms crossed, mouth zipped. She seemed unhinged. She stormed out of the room, muttering complaints to my mother, who yelled louder for me to wake up. I kicked the covers off, stretching and collapsing my limbs, before relaxing into my waking self. I lingered in my own touch, daring a quiet and quick exploration, cupping my breasts, running fingertips over flesh and folds. I wasn't sure exactly when my body had changed, but it seemed to have done so in secret. I'd woken up one day the previous summer with Bollywood breasts, curvy hips, and long legs. My dreams realized were just the continuation of my mother's nightmare. Like my sister's, I was no longer allowed to play sports or wear shorts. Our sex was meant to be hidden, even from one another. We dressed modestly, hiding our flesh, living somewhere deep inside our skins, chaste and quiet. My mother was seated at the kitchen table, the Sunday paper splayed in front of her, sliced and dissected to the weekly flyer section. She flipped through ads for laundry detergent and dog food while talking on the phone to my sister, Serena, scrunching her face, pushing her oversized glasses up ever so slightly to magnify portions of the page. I sat next to her, drinking a cup of tea, wondering why she bothered with reading glasses when she could not read. 89 cents, I told her impatiently. Limit 6. She stared curiously at the picture of canned beans before licking the tip of her middle finger and turning the page. "A cha-cha. It's expensive. But if you buy them in the case... When you were kids, we used cloth diapers. It was so much work." "Well, you have to be disciplined. Put them on the potty every few hours. None of my children wore a diaper at his age." "A cha-cha." Her voice skipped and jumped, picking up threads from the previous day, a patchwork of words. She flipped to the next flyer, told Serena that Similac infant formula was on sale at London Drugs, then sat squinting at the fine print. "One case per household," I read for her. My mother nodded as though she expected as much. She probably did. She knew which stores had the freshest vegetables, which had the cheapest. She knew the weekly sales cycle of all the local shops, and had a well-stocked wallet of coupons grouped by date and commodity. She could figure out the price of toilet paper by the square, never fooled by the ever-changing sheet count per roll. She took her flyers and coupons to stores looking for price matches and bulk buys. She knew the clerks and cashiers by face, and at times attempted some small talk about the weather, but none of them ever returned her kindness. This only motivated her to count her change more closely, enumerating each penny on a rung of her finger, the same way she counted minutes, hours, and days. Once a cashier accused my mother of stealing a chocolate bar. The pimply-faced security guard took her to the back office and went through her purse and pockets. After finding nothing, he sent her on her way with a warning. She came home upset and confused, much the same way I did when I was teased at school. When she told me what had happened, I drove her back to store and demanded to speak to the manager. He was apologetic about it, and every time he'd seen her since, he was sure to ask her how she was doing, whether she needed anything. He even helped take her groceries to the car. My mother told everyone about it. You should have seen how Mina talked to them. They even gave us a store gift certificate. "Get dressed," my mother said, glancing at my jeans. "I am dressed." "Don't argue, not now. We're expecting guests." Phone still wedged between her ear and shoulder, she stood moving like a pecking bird, as though in a hurry, yet somehow unsure of her destination. She put the dishes in the sink and stared out the window, her marionette frame bent in at the shoulders, her head lowered. The window looked out over the neighbor's manicured lawn, the perfectly pruned boxwood hedge, and the grapes that wound along the fence. As usual on a Sunday, the neighbors were out on the lawn playing bocce. Their loud Italian voices and exuberance for life kept my mother curious, and she watched them through the broken slit in the blind, as though trying to decipher their happiness. Sometimes they saw her standing at the window and waved hello or beckoned come over. Today, as always, she turned away, seeming both embarrassed and shy, feelings that for her and me were interchangeable. "Why are you still standing there?" she said, turning on me. "I told you to change your clothes." In my room, I pulled out a plain salwar kameez from the bottom dresser drawer. The satin made me sweat, and the smell lingered into the next wear, reminding me that I hated wearing Indian suits almost as much as I hated this ritual of belated mourning. Even though my father had been dead for 16 years, there were still enough relatives to fill every Sunday with pity. It was always the same. We would get up, clean the house, do the laundry, mourn the past, and go to sleep. We existed between past dreams and present realities, never able to do anything but wait. For what? I didn't know. When I was 5, I thought we were waiting for my father to return. I had no memory of him, but attempted to stitch his life together from remnants that were everywhere. The house was full of black and white photographs of him from when we lived in England, pictures of him standing next to the guards at Buckingham Palace, and of a family in front of a tiny brick row house on Warwick Road. Even my mother's closet was full of him. His starched cotton dresses, shirts hung neatly along sports jackets that smelt like yesterday's rain. His brown and black leather shoes were lined up beneath the shirts and jackets next to a locked suitcase that I pulled out to stand on in order to reach the top of the closet. Buried on the top shelf, I found an attaché case full of documents, which I could not yet read, and behind it, a photo album and shoe polish kit. Resisting the urge to shine my father's shoes, I sat cross-legged beneath the empty embrace of hollow-armed suit jackets and opened the album. The yellowing photos made every face look familiar. They were the usual assortment of pictures, birthdays, weddings, picnics, except for 4 on the last page that were turned over. I sat for a moment wondering what was on the other side before pulling back the plastic protector and peeling one of the photos off the sticky surface. It was a picture of my father in a pink satin-lined coffin. A long garland of spring flowers like the ones I'd seen worn by newlyweds was draped around his neck. His eyes were closed and weighted, his shoulders rigid, chest tight, as though he were holding his breath. My heart skipped and fell, the descending beats echoed in my chest. I put the photo back in the album and the album back on the top shelf, preserving my father's death just as my mother had so carefully preserved the details of his life. Just as my father's mother, my daddy, had when she'd come to Canada to mourn her son 5 years after his death. How we remember, my daddy told me and my sisters. This is how we exist. The past is the only thing that matters, she said, shaking her head like a slow pendulum between bitter glances at our braids. It is the only thing we know. We cannot make something out of nothing. That is for God to do. This is what we were told. This is who we were. After dressing, I returned to the kitchen to finish my breakfast. I was always a slow eater. My mother had to force feed me as a child, every spoonful of curry followed by a gulp of water to wash it down. I hated the bitter sabji, soft and chunky mounds of potatoes and cauliflower. Shit. That's what the white kids at school had said my leftover lunches looked like. Mina eats shit. Ted shuffled by me, pushing the vacuum with one hand while balancing a laundry basket of wet clothes on her hip like a baby. She leaned against the table and pushed the basket towards me. Your turn to put these on the line to dry. And you have to vacuum. Mom and I are going to the Indian stores to get groceries. She held up a list of chores that I would need to complete by the time they returned. I took the list from her, crumpling it in my free hand as I opened the porch door to hang the laundry out. Our porch backed onto a fenced-in grid of suburban yards dotted with broken-down garden sheds and vegetable plots that were a haven for squirrels and other rodents. No matter how quickly we picked up and composted the rotten apples and spoiled cherries, the critters would come by from the nearby bog, skulking along the top of our rickety fence in the search of a meal. Once one of the kids at school saw me chasing a raccoon off our garbage bins with a broom handle and looked disgusted, as though having raccoons in our neighborhood was somehow my fault. We lived in one of the older grids in North Delta, a suburb just outside of Vancouver, where the large evergreens and pines were dying a slow death, mostly by years of crowding and years of various untreated seasonal diseases that caused the bark to peel away in long, ragged strips. The houses on our street had been bought and sold several times and were victim to shoddy renovations, like the slanted sunroom addition next door. New neighborhoods were devoid of such things. The ones built on the flattened forests above the ravine had courts, boulevards, and crescents that wound around one another to panoramic views of Boundary Bay. Each new cedar house there looked onto both a dogwood tree planted in the sidewalk meridian and a carefully manicured postage stamp-sized front yard filled with some variation of tulips or daffodils. Behind those cedar fences, draped in clematis, were the popular girls, who spent their weekends sunbathing, sometimes topless, so the boys at school said, listening to Casey Kasem's American Top 40. On a clear day, I could almost hear them splashing in their pools and singing along with Madonna. None of them had to chase away raccoons and spend their Sundays hanging their knickers on a clothesline for the world to see. I snapped the mismatched sheets in the air and pegged them onto the line. In the distance, a squall of cloud was rising, and I wondered how long it would be before the rain set in. Halfway through my washload hanging, Liam appeared, walking towards the house, his long after shadow turning corners before he did. As always, he was wearing his headphones, and I wondered if he was listening to the mixed tape I'd made him for his birthday. I'd met him at the beginning of grade 12. He transferred from Holy Trinity and at first didn't go to class, preferring to wander the hallways and occasionally kick a locker door as he passed. He was rumored to have been expelled from the Catholic school, but no one knew why. Some kids suspected he'd been kicked out for drug use, and others had heard that he'd been in one too many fights, but what everyone agreed on was that he was best left a loner. Whenever he walked by, people veered out of his way, and in the crowded hallways, he stood apart from the others in what seemed like contented arrogance. Moments before our first meeting, I was rushing across the field, my face tucked into an armload of books to avoid the sun's glare. And as I approached the school's main entrance, I saw him scaling the face of the building as if he were Spider-Man. Just as I was about to walk by, he jumped down, falling at my feet. Startled, I dropped my books. The bell rang. I was late. I knelt down and began collecting the books, occasionally grasping at my papers as they fluttered in the breeze, threatening to take flight. Liam handed me a stack of papers and a few books. History. You don't want to lose that one. Actually, I would, but thanks. I looked up to take them from him. The sun should have been in my eyes, but he had eclipsed everything. Later that same day, I'd found myself sitting in front of him in history. The teacher hadn't arrived, and the class was on the verge of the usual anarchy. Liam slumped over his desk, decking under a paper airplane as he tapped my back with his pen. Meninder, right? Mina, I corrected, wondering how he knew my full name. He squinted and nodded his head as if to say, all right, yeah. He had a face that was older than his age, a square jawline and blue eyes that changed color depending on the light. You live in the beige house, the one with the fucked up trees? I hesitated, not wanting to encourage a conversation. Yeah? Why? He leaned back into his chair until the front legs lifted off the ground. So you want to get out of here? And go where? Does it matter? When I said it did, he smirked as if I had missed something obvious and left the classroom, leaving me alone and surrounded by kids who acted like I didn't exist. After class, he was waiting outside and asked if he could walk home with me. After working up the courage, I asked him where he ended up going, and he told me, you know, just around. He always said, you know, as though I did know. Somehow, it made me think I did. I pegged the last of the wash on the line and cranked it out towards the remaining patch of sun. Liam stood beneath the porch and looked up. What's up? I asked. Nothing. Thought I was going downtown. Thought you might want to come. I can't. I looked to see if my mother had seen us talking. We're expecting company, and I have stuff to do around here. Like laundry, he said, picking up a few of the pegs that I dropped. When he started up the steps to hand them to me, I rushed down the stairs, carrying the basket in front of me so he wouldn't see me in my Indian clothes. Though I suspected he would have seen beyond it. He never seemed to notice when my hair smelt like curry or when I wore the same clothes 2 days in a row. I took the pegs from him. He was smiling or smirking at me. I couldn't tell which. His slight underbite made everything seem like a flirtation or a dare. I stood there in his silence. He was often like this. He didn't feel the need to speak, to fill in the blanks, to use up air. Maybe we could do something tomorrow, I suggested. That'd be cool, he said. Mina, my mother yelled from the window in a tone that matched the glare she shot at Liam. Look, I gotta go. I'll see you tomorrow. I rushed back upstairs, took the empty basket inside, walking by Tej and my mother, who were on their way out. Gora? A white boy? My mother snapped. He said hi. What was I supposed to do, not talk to him? I pushed the vacuum into the living room and flicked it on, drowning out any hope my mother had of lecturing me about talking to white boys. So I will stop there. Thank you. So, questions. They're always a difficult thing. People are always frightened to ask the first one. So I'm going to make it easy. And I'm going to ask myself the question that most people ask me. And hopefully that will, by then you'll have your questions formed. Most people ask how much of this book is autobiographical. And I've always said that it's been very much informed by my life. I had a similar upbringing, have five older sisters, and raised by a widowed mother, and live in the community that Mina lives in. And so I use that to kind of inform her life. But thankfully, my life was never and is not as tragic as hers is. But I think that the lines between fiction and nonfiction have begun to blur, that more writers are inserting themselves into narrative. And for me, that's partly one of the reasons I write. It's my way to understand the world. So definitely informed by my life, but certainly not my life. Over to you.
I assume you're working on another novel now?
I am, much more slowly than I would like. This novel has been quite linear. It was a linear book, and in terms of even the narrative. It's a novel. This one's told in four parts. And it jumps forward in time, but all the gaps are explained for the reader. So it moves back and forward. So at the end of it, you have an overall view of Mina's life. In the new book I'm writing, it's more of an episodic novel that is not going to explain for the reader what has happened or what will happen. So it's been more challenging to write because I have to deliberately know things for myself that I'm not going to explain to the reader. So it's been challenging to write something that's disjointed but still coherent.
I read in one of your interviews that you usually know the end of the story and then you work backwards. So can you kind of explain the process that you go in terms of working back?
Yeah, and for me, I generally know a beginning. I know an end, and as I write, that happens in images. So it's not that the story comes fully formed, but there may be an image or an idea that stays with me for a long period of time. And so, for example, in Everything Was Goodbye, it was the image of these two teenagers walking through cherry blossoms in springtime. And it's about trying to understand a whole story when you've been given a piece of a puzzle. So for me, I knew that piece of the puzzle, and then I had to develop something around it to satisfy myself as to why that even meant anything to me. So it's not necessarily a specific work back, but it's almost like that the novel appears in clues in my daily life, images or texts or news stories or things that really resonate me and with me, and I have no real understanding of why. My job to figure it out. I think Sarah Selecki said it best. She's a wonderful writer of short stories. She said that all of the stories are fully somewhere, but they're just outside your peripheral, and it's your job as the writer to kind of reach outside yourself and find it, because it's just always eluding you somehow. Because often people wonder, well, how do you write a novel but you don't know what it's about? And I think it's because you have a sense of it, but you're not able to articulate it. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if that answered your question.
No, that's great. Thank
okay.
you.
Yes?
Is the kind of story you're trying to tell, does it determine the form? So you say this story is linear, and then you're doing episodic for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Or did you decide you wanted to try an episodic narrative or that went back and forth disjointedly? Or does the thing you want to say tell you you want to be disjointed?
I think the thing that I want to say tells me that I have to be disjointed. I'd much rather write in a linear manner, because in your mind you can always say, and then what happens, and then what happens, and then what happens, and you have that sense of forward momentum, where in this next book it feels very fractured. There is no momentum. The novel, it's told in second person, in a you instead of an I or a he or a she, and so that determines its form as well. You know, and it's also trial and error. Even in this first book, I wrote it from several points of views before settling on first person the way it was. And in fact, at one point when I realized its structure wasn't working, I actually was quite geeky about it, and I mapped out in a bar graph how I moved from present to past, and I realized that there was a section of the novel that wasn't working anymore because it was no longer doing that. And as a writer, you train your reader on what form and how you're writing. So when you break away from that form, even without knowing, you ruin the flow. So I realized by making that graph that I had broken my form. So sometimes, you know, you're so deep in it that you're not necessarily consciously thinking about form and the continuity of the reading experience until much later. So probably with this next one, I will, once I have a fully finished draft, go back and assess whether I have created a consistent form for the reader to exist inside the narrative. So I'm very technical. It's mostly trial and error.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about writing in the second person, how that works?
Yeah, how it's working and not working for me. So second person for me has always been a challenge, because whenever I read second person narratives, whenever I read anything that says you went to the store or you like the rain, I've always found it very telling and very confrontational. Whenever I've read something and I've picked it up and I've read it, my first thought is, don't tell me about myself. And so I'm taking the you in terms of a more omniscient narrator. I've always imagined that you have two parts of yourself. There is the part of you that is consciously living your existence and inside it. But I also believe there's a part of you that is more aware of your existence and your purpose. And so for this next novel, I'm actually writing from, this gets confusing, from the you that is inside you. So the you that is Gurjinder, but over here, and has a real sense of what she's doing in an objective manner. I'm kind of experimenting with it being second person, but still part of the first person experience. And now you're gonna have to wait 5 years to see what that actually looks like.
So could you possibly say that this is like the psychological separation between id and ego?
It very much so. That's part of it. You know, the separation of our conscious, our subconscious, our ego, our alter ego. There is that, but I'm also really interested in the interplay of our lives in terms of reincarnation. You know, so much of the world believes in reincarnation, yet mostly North American societies don't. So I'm also curious of, you know, what if the subconscious knows things about previous lives and has an understanding of how we live our life currently and how that relates back. So I'm also curious about the spiritual you. You know, and my challenge is to do that in a way that doesn't seem cheesy. It doesn't seem like magical realism or anything like that. So I've been quite tentative with that. Because I think that there is, you know, we live our lives on this linear, I'm born, I die. But if we open ourselves up to something else, could we be influenced by experiences we don't actually remember having? So I'm playing around with that within the second preview as well.
So you used the word cheesy in connection with magical realism. Does that mean you don't like magical realism?
I like magical realism. I think it's there's so many ways about with magical realism. Like sometimes you read a magical realism book and you know that that's what you're getting. You know that that's the writer that you picked up. You accept it right from the get-go. And I think that in that form it really works very well. I think that for me the danger of being cheesy is I'm not setting out to write a book that exists in magical realism. I want to have elements, but I want it to be so subtle that you barely notice until after you read the book and then it, you know, sits there for a few days and you realize that there were all these other things happening. And so the reason I think it can be cheesy is I haven't read a book like this, but I've, you know, seen movies where it seems like a contemporary film and all of a sudden strange things are happening. And again, unless you set it up for the reader or the viewer of a movie that this is what you're getting, I think that people can be really disappointed. So that's why I don't want it to come across as cheesy or as gimmicky.
Or easy.
Yeah, that the things are easily explained because there's a magical world. And I also struggle with it. You know, if I'm going to play with the themes of reincarnation, to me, reincarnation isn't magical realism. To me, reincarnation is what, you know, probably 60% of the world believes in. So how do I honor that and yet make it believable for a North American audience?
Well, after you said it, I was sitting here trying to think. I went back to your roots and said, what if I wrote an Indian magical realism? Mm-hmm. What would that be like? I mean, because of, you know, like that elephant god, whose name is, I can't remember. But, you know, it's sort of, to me, magical realism is like heightened reality almost. Like things have an aura.
Yes.
Even though they're ordinary.
Yeah, and that's a great way to...
Latin Americans do it well.
Yeah, they do it very well. And then when I think about that, if I go back to the mythology and the Hindu mythology, again, I understand that from my North American perspective, to me that looks like magical realism. But I must honor that that is their fundamental belief.
Yeah.
That it's not magic. It's realism. So it's that space between honoring a belief and making it just as believable for everybody else. So, like I said, I'm not sure how long it will take. We'll see how it works out. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain. We can be found online at www.cjsf.ca. We'd like to thank both SFU Special Collections and Gurjinder Bazaran for providing us with that content. Gurjinder Bazaran is a fiction writer from North Delta and a graduate of SFU's Writers Studio. We just heard Gurjinder read from her debut novel, Everything Was Goodbye. More information about her and her...
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template